Well, all right, thanks. So it's not exactly like this, eh? Because, well, let's say if this is, let's say, AMO, right? And this is condensed mat, probably like this. Right? Still not the scale, right? So my contribution, let's say, original contribution was something like this. Right? And what Victor wanted me to do is to explain, you know, something from here to people from there. You know? So let's say maybe it works. We'll see. So let me start with the this is a tutorial. I'm not going to present any original results. So don't kill me. So we work with alkali atoms, right? One alkali atom consists of a nuclei, a bunch of electrons, and the most important of which is the last one, which occupies this s orbital. So the principal quantum number is 1, 2, and so on, and L is 0. And if it's 1, we have hydrogen, 2 is lithium, 3 sodium, potassium, rubidium, cesium, etc. Right? So the nuclei has a spin. So typically, the most, let's say, for bosons, the most popular is 3/2. So E equals 3/2. And S is all, electronic spin is always 1/2. For bosons, this is half integer. For fermions, it's integer. For lithium, I equals 1. The Hamiltonian of one atom, let's say, in the magnetic field, the most important terms are the hyperfine interaction plus this guy. And I neglect the B and I because this one is very small. Right. So this gives the this is the basically hyper. This gives you hyperfine structure. The good quantum numbers without magnetic field is F. Is I plus S. So for example, for lithium atoms where I is 1, S is 1/2, we have F equals 1/2. F equals 3/2 states. And usually people write it like this. So
why does it say it doesn't say I equal to 3/2, and now you're saying I is 1?
Okay, this is for rubidium. This is for rubidium and for like three other alkalis, but for lithium it's 1. Okay, I'm sorry. This can be like 1 or 1/2 or 3/2, depends on the
isotope.
Yes, you give me the isotope, I look in the book, and I will tell you what is what is I.
So when you're saying that for lithium I is 1, you haven't learned a particular isotope.
Yes, lithium 6, sure. Yes, all right. I don't have a table with me, but I know that for rubidium is 3/2 and for lithium is 1. Okay. For rubidium 87. Right. So and typically they write it like this. So this hyperfine structure is like this, right? This is F equals 1/2, F equals 3/2, and this is the hyperfine splitting, which is of the order of gamma. Well, it's equal, huh? Okay, for boson, this will be like more states. Lithium is a little bit simpler. This is lithium 6. Lithium 6. Lithium 6. Lithium 6. Yes. 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 For fermions, F is always half integer, right? What happens with the states when the magnetic field is increased is well, is a well, well known basically. All experimentalists, they draw this thing quite, you know, fast. There are two states, which are this and that, with nuclear and electronic spins, what they call doubly polarized states, which do not couple to other states in the magnetic field. So this go like this. Then we have, okay, this is the magnetic field. This is the, okay, these are the degenerate, like this is a hyperfine splitting, right? So here we have two states which go like this. And here they're like this. I personally prefer to think, you know, about this picture at high magnetic fields, because then what happens is very simple. The electronic spin SZ is minus 1/2, and here SZ is plus 1/2, because magnetic field, this field is of the order of 100 Gauss. This field is when the Zeeman energy becomes comparable with the hyperfine splitting. Right. Well, for lithium, the important magnetic fields are 800 Gauss, so we can, like, at least qualitatively, we can think that, let's say, nuclear spin and electronic spins are decoupled. And this is basically, what is it? This is IZ equals 1, 0, minus 1.
Between IZ states at
high this one? Yeah, hyperfine interaction?
It's hyperfine.
Yes,
so it's the order of hyperfine interaction.
It's 1/2, I believe. It's yes, because it, yeah, it's one gamma divided by 2. Physically, what this gamma is the following thing is, it contains Bohr magneton, nucleon magneton, right? And the overlap, so basically the wave function of this electron at point zero squared. Well, the probability to find it there. So typically it depends on the on the number of electrons that screen the potential. So it's different for hydrogen, lithium, etc. All right. So okay, this is a one atom picture, and I'm, you know, have problems with space now. Okay, let's see. So now I have two atoms, right? Two atoms. How do they interact? So the kinetic energy is one over two mu. Mu is the reduced mass. One over r. Plus this interaction of the first guy, I1S1. Plus Zeeman terms. That's it. Now they are not. They do not interact. Now they do not interact, and the, let's say, and the most important contribution to the interaction, it comes from the so-called central potential, and it's written like this: U_s plus 3 U_t divided by 4 plus the exchange U_t minus U_s S1. This one is basically what has the van der Waals tail at large distances. So basically, if we have, let's assume that electrons are different, then if we have let's say this atom and that atom. We fix the atom. We fix the positions of the nuclei, and then we try to, you know, we find this Born-Oppenheimer potential curve for the electrons. And the first term basically at large distances is C6 minus C6 divided by R to the 6. It comes from the dipole-dipole interaction between between the atoms in the second order. So namely, dipole-dipole interaction goes like D1 D2 minus 3 D1 R D2 R divided by R cube, let's say in atomic units. So if I have a neutral, well, not even like this, if I have alkali atoms, then the average dipole moment is zero. That means that I cannot just put simple, you know, in the first order I have zero. But the second order effect is basically when this guy is excited to a p orbital, and this guy is excited to, well, let's say another p orbital, then they give this guy, and C6 coefficient can be written like 6 sum over all the excited states of the first atom, new one, all excited states of the second atom, and then I write it as new 1 dz new 2 sorry 0. Well, let's say E not one. So, okay, the states that contribute mostly to this sum is basically the, you know, let's say, for example, for lithium and higher alkalis, these are the states with the same principal number, but with L equals 1. So this, because dz then couples them. For hydrogen, the situation is a bit different because electron cannot, well, there is no state with the principal number equals 1. So it has to change the principal number and L. So for hydrogen, this guy is of the order of one atomic unit, and for other alkalis, it's basically this Coulomb degeneracy that's broken. So C6 coefficients for alkalis.
Can you change?
Yes.
The short range part.
I will come to that. This is just what happens at large distances, right? And I just wanted to show why these distances are large. C6 coefficient, let's say. Hydrogen, lithium. Okay, I should write hydrogen, right? Because I consider these collisions. Sodium, potassium, rubidium. This part of the potential does not depend on the isotope. So there is only very small mass scaling, but it doesn't depend on statistics, nothing. Cesium. Okay, here we go. This is 6.5 in atomic units. 1393. Six eight five one. The reason why is not of the order of one in atomic units is what I just said. So this guy is of the order of one. more or less, let's say. And here we have the difference between, like, if these atoms are just pure Coulomb atoms, basically the difference here is zero then, because there is a degeneracy. Well, the degeneracy is like this. N, let's say for lithium, N is 1, right, the principal quantum number, and L can be 0 or 1. So these two states, 1, 0 and 1, 1, they shouldn't be different in energy. But the degeneracy is broken by the, you know, by the screening effects. And that's why it goes like this, because the screening effects well, basically, this guy, as I said, hydrogen, it has to change n, so it's of the order of Hartree, you know, this energy.
Are you trying to say why C6 isn't unity? I mean, why would you think that would be true?
Sorry?
What are you trying to explain?
I'm trying to explain. You see the trend is that for hydrogen it's like of the order of 1.
Okay.
And this guy is basically 3 orders of magnitude. And the reason is that, well, do you understand what I'm saying?
No.
Or actually, should I like go faster or it's all right? I mean, I don't know.
I think
really.
The pace is all right. Here, I think you were... maybe even too slow. I don't know. I'm not sure, but I can imagine that some people don't understand the very last
argument.
Are these experimental numbers or theoretical numbers?
Do you actually measure them?
Yeah, how they measure it is the following thing. Can I just answer your question just in a little while?
That's fine.
Okay. So, because, well, you can do spectroscopy.
Huh? Is the answer experimental or not?
We can do it both, basically. But you see, if you ask the guys from like AMO, they think in completely different, like, for example, they're thinking about like 1% precision of this number. And it's important for them, because you change C6 by just a little bit, the scattering length changes randomly. So for them it's like, for me it doesn't matter whether the C6 is like 1,000 or 1,100.
Yeah.
But yeah, because physics is there. But in order to calculate this, you know, scattering phase shift, for example, you need to know this precisely. Well, actually, there are...
Just a short question so I understand why C6 gives such big numbers. So what you're saying is that, except for hydrogen, you're going to larger N, and you can add various numbers for L, then the slight degeneracy splitting in between these different orbital bands, those are rather small, create a small...
Yeah, they're smaller than atomic units.
Okay.
Atomic unit is Hartree, is the...
Okay.
Is how much energy you should, well, spend to go from n equals 1 to n equals 2, for example. To go from L equals 0 to 1 costs nothing. Well, I mean...
Jim, so your point is that they're increasing because there's more degeneracy to go up to higher alpha.
This is what... Okay. There is some... Probably I can start to explain that, and maybe I will be mistaken on the even number of times. But the interplay is like, you know, the charge that screens the Coulomb interaction, so the splitting becomes, let's see, it becomes larger, but I believe that these guys start to be... you see, I'm not ready to discuss this thing, but there is some change with this Z. Yeah. There is so-called this strength, you know, this oscillator strength of the transition, and this oscillator strength is of the order of 1. Oscillator strength is basically okay. Let's see.
Well, if the denominator completely is constant, then there's some rule that controls the sum. But there's some slight difference. So definitely deviations are rather small. But I think the answer is indeed that there's a fine, there's a splitting. It's not degenerate. The scale is fine. It's a fine structure scale, and then that needs to be.
Okay, actually, you know, Jason, I would prefer to go on,
yeah.
You know,
to,
because this, you know, is pretty, you know, simple. Okay, the range that comes. Okay, so this one I will rewrite in the way h bar squared divided by 2 mu. Re to the 4 divided by r to the 6 with minus sign. And this is an important scale. So, the formula for Re follows directly from this. So it is Re, have to take C6 coefficient, multiply it by reduced mass, and put it in the power of 1/4. So typical, for example, for rubidium, Re is of the order of 100 Bohr radii, 50 angstrom. And it is much larger than the size, than the, let's say, extent of the electronic wave function. So this one is of the order of 1 Bohr radii, and Re is much larger. That's why some people call this interaction long range. But for us, it's still short range, you see? Okay. Exchange interaction. So exchange interaction appears when you say that, well, this electron has statistics. Right?
What did you quote for Re, roughly?
Hmm? 100. For rubidium, for rubidium it's 100. For lithium it's about 50 angstrom, and for cesium is larger, something like 120 or 130. Right. So exchange interaction comes into play when you realize that there is statistics. Basically, it was shown in 1960 something that basically exchange interaction comes from, let's say, distance between nuclei. So when two electrons come to this distance, and basically the exchange interaction is exponential. So it goes like E minus 2 alpha R, and there is a power for Coulomb potential. The power I really don't know, but it's related to alpha. It's related to the wave function of the last electron in the Coulomb potential. So it's basically square of this guy, right? And this guy is also relatively long range, because, well, you see, it cuts off at distances related to the ionization energy, right, of the electron. So in principle, if we sum this guy and that guy, we get a potential that looks like this. Well, something like this. But of course, it's wrong. I mean, if you start to calculate anything, it's wrong, because you have to include 1 over R8, 1 over R10, all these dispersive, terms in, quadrupole, dipole, and higher order terms, right? So, but for us, what is important is the following thing, is that how do we, let's see what the plan is. The solution of the Schrödinger equation in this potential, I would like to say how people calculate that. This is Re, let's say, this is of the order of Bohr radii, and let's say that there is somewhere there, is 1 over k, where k is the, de Broglie wavelength of, 1 over k is the de Broglie wavelength of colliding particles. So what people do, they divide this space in three regions. Let's say region 1. Here, they safely assume that the energy is zero. And they can do WKB approximation for the wave function here. Very good approximation. Right? In this region here, okay, this region is much much larger than A naught, much smaller than RE. And this is much larger than RE, much smaller than 1 over K.
Could you move the figure to the center, to the middle or
No, it, let's say it's a 100. And this one, you know, it's another two orders of magnitude larger, this De Broglie wavelengths. Right? So they divide into these regions, 1, 2, 3. Here they use E equals 0 and WKB. But in fact, it's not necessary to use E equals 0 because WKB. Here, in this region, they use E equals 0 and exact solution of the Schrödinger equation in the minus RE to the 4 R6 potential. And here, they match it with a free wave. Free wave.
So you said R is order 100 for radius, right? So
yes.
It's basically about, say, 0.1 micrometer.
No, it's a 50 angstrom. I believe it's much smaller. It's like, it's 10 nanometers.
But you're using some Micrometer is 10,000 angstroms. So.
Yes, so that's
still. Well, yeah, so.
Of the same order. I mean, so if you have a. If you have higher density, you say the density is like 10 to the...
Yeah, you get metal, piece so, chunk of metal.
So I see.
If you want, we can discuss this three-body recombination constant, and you will see that you cannot have it like very dense, really. You will get, you know, clusters forming.
Is that experimentally seen, or is just, I mean... It's obvious.
Three-body recombination?
No, the fact that you get a chunk of metal.
I can see it just, you know, when looking.
But in real metal, probably. I was asking, have the metal cold out of suspense? I mean, I know metal.
No.
Do you like them?
No, I don't know. They have it very, I mean, when three-body recombination, the products are very hot.
Okay, so
you lose them.
So the maximum density people can shift could be just 10 to the 14.
Okay, for rubidium 87, recombination rate constant is like 10 to the minus 27, I think, centimeter 6 per second. And you see, you can calculate. You have to multiply by density squared, which is the maximum density is probably 10 to the 15 per centimeter cube. And then it grows very rapidly. So the rate will go like alpha recombination times density squared. So make one order of magnitude more, and it goes to milliseconds, lifetime. That's why it's like this. All right, but what I wanted to say is that this region for us, it's, well, qualitative reason is not important. This region provides with the phase of the wave function here, this WKB phase. And people solved this problem and found that the scattering length in this potential is actually RE multiplied by, I don't know, what do you prefer, let's say, this number is of the 0.5, basically, times 1 minus tangent of the phase let's say. People solve this problem for a hard wall here, let's say, and they can shift this wall, basically change the phase, the WKB phase here, and see how it behaves. So the scattering length is a function of, let's say, phase, goes like this. So it has a average, kind of average value of the order of 0.5 RE.
Sorry, how is phase defined in this?
For the hard wall, let's say if we put hard wall here, the phase here is zero. So you start with sine, let's say sine integral from, let's say, let's call it R naught, RC to R, square root of interaction potential function of R, dr, right?
At the moment, you're ignoring spin, or this particular spin channel.
This is I ignore spin. Let's say I ignore spin. Yes. So the phase is, well, you have a lot of oscillations here. The wave function oscillates very rapidly, and then it goes to some, you know.
But I mean, it really depends on k. I mean, there's some relationship between k and phi, right?
K is the momentum. Practically not.
Oh.
Practically, well, does not depend on k here at this region. Of course, it's, even at this region, I mean, everywhere in the region number 2, it doesn't depend. The small parameter there is k times re. So if this guy is much smaller than 1, you can completely neglect, you know, in this potential scattering problem, you can completely neglect k for this distance. The wave function is the same. Won't change. Let me clean the mess, right? Okay, well, the statement here is that the scattering length is on average of the order of RE, so it is large in the sense of, you know, for and very profound statement is that, let's say, the probability to find scattering length which is larger than 1 is 3 times larger, let's say 3/4, and this one, sorry, it's out of scale a little bit, and this one is 1/4. So if you have infinite number of isotopes, infinite number of atoms, and you make statistics of what kind of scattering length is there in 75%, sorry, excuse me, in 66.6% of cases, you find positive scattering length, and in the other, you will find negative scattering length. Well, if you have infinite number of like atoms and species and something like this, this phi is determined by the, you know, short range potential here.
So does it mean that short range potential is completely random, or it's the same for
all? No. Okay, we have only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 like alkalis. And only for, let's say, for rubidium 87, the scattering length is of the order of the background scattering. And for some channels in lithium also. I'm saying if I can make 100 or like 1,000 of alkalis with different potentials, and then if I plot the scattering lengths as a function of, let's say, RE, then I will see that they go on, you know, on a line, and they will be, you know, statistically they will be positive on average. All right.
But the lithium and the cesium are negative.
Sorry?
I mean, so this...
Yeah, I define it like minus C6 divided by R6. The potential is minus.
Yes, I mean, for the scattering length, for lithium, I mean, okay, that depends on the magnetic field. What you're saying is without magnetic field.
Yeah, without.
Magnetic field for lithium is positive.
C6 is... Okay. The potential is attractive but the scattering length is statistically it's positive. Let's say. I believe that it was important in like beginning of 90s where people were looking for a nice isotope, you know, to make BEC. And for BEC, you need positive scattering length. Some people, you know, were lucky and some people were not, as we know. So, nobody knew the scattering length before. So they knew C6 coefficient, but the short-range physics, I mean, exchange potential. Like triplet and singlet potentials, let's say they are different only by the exchange part. So the long range tail is the same. C6 coefficient is the same. Let's say that this is a triplet potential and this one is singlet. And the scale is of the order of like thousands of kelvins. This is something completely, you know, so probably 1,000 kelvins. In rubidium, there are hundreds of vibrational states in this potential. For lithium, it's something like 35 or 37. And even, you know, the singlet potential, is this one is probably maybe 10 times less deep than this one. But there are still a lot of levels there. Very peculiar thing that I would like to mention is that they also introduced the scattering lengths for triplet and singlet potentials. And, you know, also they write this thing as the, okay, you can substitute AS and AT everywhere here with a delta function potential, right? So when triplet scattering length equals singlet scattering length, we don't have exchange. So basically, if the atoms, in an incoming channel, you have, for example, singlet electronic state, it will become, okay, mixed state, then it will not change. It will be the same state if AT equals AS.
What are those two potentials? Okay.
S1 times S2 has, let's say, eigenstates 1/4 and -3/4. This is for triplet and this is for triplet and this is for singlet, right? So if you substitute 1/4 for triplet potential, then you have only UT, which is left, only UT, triplet potential. And when you substitute -3/4, you should have US. Is it true? Yes. Yes. Yes, this is true. So let's say S1, S2. That's why if the atoms, let's say have a certain all right, the problem with this Hamiltonian is that these guys at low magnetic field they mix the states, you know, so electronic spins, they're not very good numbers. But you see, the problem is then, for example, for lithium it will be 36 couple channel problem, and I wouldn't like to, you know, to dive into that. But nice thing to think about is just make a magnetic field very large, and then you can, I mean, then these are basically the kind of the colors of, I mean, the spins of nuclei are basically, you know, labeled different hyperfine, and they do not, you know, mix the states. Right, then you can talk about the singlet and triplet electronic potential. So they do not mix.
Mu t minus mu s as a form of potential goes also like one over R6.
I'm sorry. U t minus u s. This is the exchange potential. This is not zero. Well, it goes down exponentially. The tails are the same.
Because it depends on the overlap of these two.
Yeah, these are basically overlaps of electronic electrons. This is a relatively, you know, shorter range potential. But okay, it gives this repulsive.
On this picture, which one is UT and which one is US?
Sorry. Triplet potential is. I'm sorry. Jesus. I'm sorry. I just wanted to, you know, mention the triplet potential, identical. Well, they don't like each other. You know, this spins and the spins are the same. Yeah. For example, in rubidium 87, we have this miracle that UT, you know, AT. Well, miracle is the following: that the density, of the depth of the potential is very different, but AT and AS miraculously they're equal. Almost equal.
So is there any reason for that, or just
accident? It is accident. Accidental.
What kind of atoms may have larger?
All other atoms. Or you go to rubidium 87. It's, you know, they're different.
But I think UT minus US are still okay. When UT, I mean the scattering next was triplet and singlet are still quite close.
Yeah, well, they are close because they all, you know, they all of the order of magnitude of the order of RE, let's say, because of the same, you know, of this argument. But there is no reason why they should be, you know, equal, or there is a small parameter that, you know, the difference is a small parameter. There is no such thing. Well, I guess so. Yes, there are also, like, if you apply sufficiently large electric field, I'm pretty sure that you can do something, or you can do, you know, two color, you know, kind of photo association where you couple only the, you know, singlet or only triplet channel with some other states. So,
just a clarification: you said you wanted us to think about these two potentials in large field limit. I guess what you mean there is one potential for up, up, down, down, and the other for up, down, down, up.
Yes. And actually, it will shift with the... Okay, I would really like to plot it now with this guy. So if the magnetic field is large, but on this scale, it would be like this, I believe. Sorry, why there are two US?
Should erase the top one?
Yes, erase the top US.
Okay.
Do you ignore the difference spin here or
no? I ignore nuclear spin. Well, I don't ignore it. I keep it. Well, what I plotted is this one, let's say.
I thought in the high field limit, the electron spin was fixed.
Yes. Yes. And then we would be in the.
That's why
this. This is two.
But singlet should be higher. Singlet is the closest.
Shit. Well, you're right. Well, okay. Let me draw it again.
Yeah, the closed channel is.
Like this, and like this. This will be US, and this will be UT. Does this sound reasonable?
Yeah.
Then you just choose one particular triplet, or?
I don't know.
Yeah. So you choose the lowest triplet.
Yes. Yes.
Why the other ones don't matter?
This is one component.
Which one is it? S equals.
He's looking at the most ineffective between the.
Okay. This one, this, and this one is like this. Okay, if I plot again this diagram. Let's say the triplet. What I mean by triplet? So SZ equals minus 1/2. And let's assume that I So if I take, for example, let's say if I take a fermion, right, and I want them to collide an S wave channel, then I can take this one and this one. The electronic wave function will be symmetric. Let's say, yeah, symmetric. And the nuclear spin wave function is anti-symmetric for S wave.
Then the splitting is not mu b, it's given by gamma.
No. This splitting is when you, for example, when you flip one electronic spin and you go there. Let's say this one goes in here. Let's say.
Okay.
So this one is 2 Bohr magneton times b.
Two atoms in the lower state, and then that's the virtual state of the.
Yeah, yeah. The virtual state is basically when one of them is with Sz equals minus half. Well,
yeah, okay.
It's already in the singlet, you know, but potential. Okay. So, well, I mean, the rest probably you probably know. So, if we have a state in the singlet potential, which is close to the threshold for the.
I have also another suggestion. So, since the singlet actually doesn't feel magnetic field at all, I would shift zero to the singlet part.
Okay.
No.
Why not?
Well, yeah, the closed. Well, okay. So the terminology is like this: the closed channel is the channel, you know, where particles cannot escape to infinity. So the energy is below the dissociation threshold for this channel. And strictly speaking, when we talk about bound states, then both channels are closed, in fact. But they still keep this this name for open channel, even if we are like a little bit below this its threshold. Because, okay, the two channel is open channel and closed channel.
No,
right?
Your bound state needs to go further. It's not touching the other. It's not touching on the left on the right curve. I just need a line.
Your horizontal line.
So it's a bound state in use of S. I'm saying your horizontal line needs to go.
Alright, I'm sorry. Okay, I don't understand what you're saying, but let me just continue. Let's assume there is no there is no coupling between these two channels in this Hamiltonian. Well, there is, but I neglect it, right? I say that there is no coupling, and I need something that couples these two channels, and this something is a magnetic dipole interaction. that I don't know where to write, actually. Probably here. The magnetic dipole-dipole interaction is like a couple of orders of magnitude smaller than, let's say, this exchange term. And it goes like to Bohr square divided by R cube S let's say in lithium, this is the mechanism that leads to. Of course, there is some coupling, but I really don't know the numbers. And you see, okay. Like this. So what it does the following thing. Well, the usual picture, right? So the two spins, they interact with each other with the anisotropic kind of potential. So what this guy wants, it wants to. For example, we consider in triplet like this, two electrons are like this. What they want to do, they want to flip one spin. And at the same time, change the orbital wave function, coupling from L equals 0, for example, to L equals 1. So this guy couples, let's say, S wave wave function in the open channel to a this quasi-stationary state in the singlet potential with L equals 2. Okay. So the closed channel is L equals 2 because of this thing. That's basically all that I need to proceed to this Feshbach, basically, resonance. And the pictures you know. What happens is that this coupling provides you the coupling between these two channels, and then you have, let's say, the very simplified picture is the coupled channel Hamiltonian, or two coupled channels, which go like minus. Let's put it this way. And this problem is kind of was solved by Braith and Wigner in the beginning of the last century, but not this one. But the problem. Okay, all this like resonances at the quasi-stationary levels, they are known for a while. And basically, for example, the collision of two particles in this kind of potential can be also rewritten in terms of a coupled channel. Or the other, mechanism of this Braith-Wigner resonance is basically this. For example, we have only one channel, but we can couple this state, for example, from the threshold to some, you know, deeply bound molecular state via two-color, you know, transition. This will give more or less the same the same equations, right? And yeah, so these equations, I don't know. I'm going to like to show how to solve them, but that's what I was asked to do. Let's see. And I mean, you have to suffer. Well, but what I know is that no matter how many times you see how people derive it, it's much better to spend 10 minutes and solve this equation yourself, and then you become an expert, you know. And it's really right. So what we do, we say, okay, let's consider which one is open. Say, okay, this one is closed. So let's assume that we know the eigenstates of this part. No, of this part. So we write it as. Yeah. So I integrated out the angular and you know the angular degrees of freedom and spin degrees of freedom. It basically goes like 1/r³.
And only this second part of dipole-dipole matters, or the first one as well?
Which one is the first one? And I mean, this one is the first.
Right.
This one is the second. All right, probably I will answer, it doesn't matter. But then you will ask, okay, this one gives the potential to this the triplet and singlet. And then I will say no, because I believe that these guys should be integrated. There is this basically gives you this spherical harmonics, L equals 2 spherical harmonics, and you integrate it out. So it's probably, it should be there. Let's see if I answer your question. okay, plus us. Let's say that there are psi p nu equals so nu. Then I write psi p in terms of sum over nu, right? I write it like psi p nu gr psi q nu minus 2 like this, right? So basically this is an inhomogeneous equation, and I invert it, and I don't have any homogeneous like terms, the solutions of homogeneous equation, because this is closed channel, and I don't consider this the continuum of states. Well, the energy.
How important are the R depends on the G? I mean, usually it's. And what is that depends, I guess?
It's 1/r³, isn't it? Well. I would say that it's not important.
Yeah.
But for what? For I mean, well, AMO physicists would say, of course,
yeah,
it's important.
Yeah, but not a number.
Yeah, but I would say that for low energy, well, it gives some number, you know. But it's short range. Short range. All right, and then you say that. Okay, if let's tune the magnetic field to resonance so that one of the denominators is almost zero, and we keep only one term, and I will keep it like this. I will just say that this term, this. Only one term, and then I substitute it back there. Well, not back, but in the first equation. And I will do it in here. It's called this delta E. This one is minus delta E. Delta E. So okay, so this equation is kind of peculiar because it looks like inhomogeneous equation, but in fact it is, because psi q stands here and there. So the solution, well, it's if I multiply the solution by any constant, it will be again the solution of this equation. But the R dependent part is only here, and it doesn't depend on the shape of psi q. So basically, I can write down the solution of this equation in the following way. Psi q equals, let's say, psi q naught, which is the solution of any solution of the homogeneous equation, right? Plus this part again. And then the green function. Now let me denote, for example, this guy. Sorry?
The matrix
are psi p naught g of r psi q naught. No. This one stands here also, because this is important. This is important because psi q is indeed without naught here. Then it would be like the first approximation, right? So an iteration. But I would like to solve it self-consistently. So let's. What I want to do now is to multiply by psi p naught r gr, take inner product of this thing, and I will have the equation for this quantity. Let's call it E. X. Then I will have equation like this: x equals. And this guy I will call alpha. Does not depend on energy even. Well, it does, but when k times Re much smaller than 1, it does not. So this one.
Why isn't the matrix element inside the integral G depends on R, right? So when I do the inversion with the Green's function, then
that's a different R.
So this one here. Here.
Yeah. So this G of R.
That's a different R.
This one.
No, that was the one.
This one.
It's not the same R used in other terms.
It's not the same R the other time. I was stepping out getting a cup of tea. I didn't know what the definition of GR is. As it stands,
that's a GR that came from multiplying on the left hand side.
So is it the same R? The question was left.
I'm sorry. G was the coupling between G was here. G psi p. Well, when it was zero, this was the original equation in the open channel.
Yeah.
Now I do alpha plus x divided by delta E, right? And this guy, I will call beta. And beta equals GE. Barely dependent on energy. Practically does not depend. I can put here one of, well, the three-dimensional green function at zero energy. Now, x equals alpha divided by 1 minus beta divided by delta E. Right? And I substituted back there in order to find psi q. Psi q equals psi q naught r plus alpha divided by 1 minus beta delta E 1 over delta E times this integral g yeah, that's it. That's it. Now, what stands here is P naught. P naught, right? Okay, this guy at large distances and at zero energy behaves like 1 minus A background divided by R. A background is, I already called it triplet, A triplet. Because for this particular case, it's A triplet. Right. So the wave function basically oscillates, but then at large distances it goes to a constant value so that it crosses zero at AT. Right? There is some constant which let's put it this way, proportional. Now this guy for large distances is 1 over R. Because when R, you integrate over R prime, R is very far, so it's 1 over R. And you get this coefficients. Of course, the problem now is that I have to take this psi q naught, substitute it back there, calculate this integral. The easiest thing is just to take, contact g. Now, the answer is basically there. But now I wanted to arrive to a result for some, model g. And I would say that the easiest way is to take, triplet potential equals zero. Let's say, so that there is no this term here, and psi q naught is 1. Ut equals 0, and g is, g of r is g multiplied by delta of r, but I have to regularize it, and I do it like this, d over dr, r. Otherwise, for one-dimensional case, I wouldn't need that. But three-dimensional I do because, for example, when I calculate, this guy, I will have one over, if this is a delta function, then it's fine because it gives me psi p naught at zero. But this guy gives 1 over r, and I don't know how to do it with g because it's a delta function. That's why I need this thing. If I do it like this, then psi q will become just 1. Beta will be 0 because this one, as I said, 1 over r, and 1 over r doesn't give anything here. 1 over r is 1, d over dr is 0. So basically the shift is not... Okay, so beta is 0. Beta equals 0. And alpha... Alpha equals psi p naught 0 g. Substituting this thing gives psi q equals 1 plus alpha divided, psi p naught star 0 g divided by delta e. Multiplied by this guy is g psi p naught g at 0 1 over 4 pi r. Because this is the green function at zero energy. And the scattering length is basically minus this guy. I wonder if it's, the sign is probably wrong. Should be minus, huh? I suspect that there is a
question.
Yes.
You call this the scattering length. How is it related to scattering?
What do you mean?
How is it related to scattering? Why is it called a scattering
length? Ah, the scattering length. Okay. Okay. The scattering length is the following: is if you have some potential, right? You have, and then this is r times psi of r. So it crosses the abscess axis at a is called scattering length. Let's say basically the easiest way to realize how it's related to scattering is, I would say that the same would be if you have a hardcore potential here with the size a, and then you have hardcore particles with the scattering length equals a. But if you want more sophisticated explanation, then it's the limit of the scattering amplitude, you know, when k goes to zero. Now, you don't say anything, but I mean,
can I ask a question? Why don't you do some hyperfine coupling?
Huh?
Gamma 1 and gamma 2, actually. They don't enter into the discussion, so they're not really relevant.
Yeah, well, okay. So for me, it's the most, let's say, difficult question that you could ask, right? What to do with these hyperfine things? And if you read books, all authors, they try to, you know, avoid this question. They say the following words, basically pronounce. This coupling, can be neglected at small distances, because this guy is much larger than the coupling. And at large distances, you just expand in the, let's say, eigenstates of the single atom states. And basically, it's a mixture, of course. It's not just an electronic and nuclear. Well, there is some coupling between S and I. And then they say that we will keep this new kind of this atomic state. But I like to think in terms of like high magnetic fields where they are completely decoupled. Then
the book says that actually. I thought there are numbers. Hyperfine.
No, I'm. You know, the books that you can read. You know, is a. Yeah, it's for example, in Pesic and Smith.
Actually, your discussion was based on. You said that the spin flip was related to this term that you wrote. S1, S2, minus V, S1,
yes.
R, right? But I think if you take the average with respect to any ground state, you will see that it's again proportional to just product of S1 and S2. So it's effectively the same as triplet single.
No.
Yeah,
because
your analysis is just
this one does not, you know, does not change the orbital. I mean, it doesn't couple to the orbital degree of freedom. And this one does.
Now, if I take the average of this second one, I will get again S1 times S2.
What means average?
What you're saying is that if you have a spherical symmetric state, if you have...
Yeah, right. It doesn't couple. It couples only orbital L equals 0 to L equals plus or minus 2. Sorry.
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah, because this guy is anisotropic.
I thought we were working at L0 only.
Right, but this one, that's what I said. This one, let's say, this one L equals, this one L equals 0, and this one L equals 2. So the bound state in L equals 2.
So a couple of different
Yes.
Yeah, because I thought that spin flip was caused by nuclear spin. because obviously the germs which are on the first line, which couple nucleus spin I to electron spin, they are actually they cause spin flips.
So no, not in the magnetic field. They cause spin flip only in very weak field because the gyromagnetic ratios differ by a factor of 2,000. So in any high field, they cannot cause. That's why he's talking about the high field limit. But the high field limit, those are inert because they cannot cause any spin flip.
But magnetic field has already been compensated by exchange, though. So I don't think that that is.
No, it has to be a quantitative argument. I mean, I'm sure in the end, somehow that the hyperfine coupling is small, is, you know, in the regime one is interesting.
Well, the question is whether it's smaller than direct spin interruption or it's bigger, and I guess it's smaller.
Right, I mean, yeah, that's a quantitative question. In fact, that term has an isotropic hyperfine coupling also. That term is also magnetic dipolar coupling. It's called hyperfine. But if the magnetic dipolar coupling between the nuclear spin and electron spin has exactly similar term, you know, so somehow that's small in the regime of interest, but I'm not sure why.
Right, so that's
in a high magnetic field, spin flip is not going to be caused by hyperfine. So that part is okay. So that perhaps is what allows you to negate.
You see, I have universal, you know, answer to your question. Which is called 36 couple channels. Then that's it. Yeah. If you want like exact stuff, there are only two channels. These two guys, this and this, which are decoupled, right? But they don't have any, you know, Fischbach resonances for the same reason.
I think in general, both have contribution. It also depends on elements. For example, Paul Julian calculated the cesium, cesium, the 60 resonances, and all match very well. And there are some are low field, so they could be.
Yeah.
I agree with Jason. In fact, Paul Julian is coming to me all the time saying nuclear are important, but then he, you know, gives me numbers. I don't understand where the numbers come from. But it comes from some very big program he's running somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe that's part of
this. I have a genius organizational idea. Because in principle, I have some stuff, but it's related to some widths of the resonance. But I would stop here, just, you know, and well, I'm here for another 2 weeks, so you're welcome to ask questions anytime. But okay.
Can you give a one-minute summary of the Wilson resonance? What is it due to?
Of what?
Any justification, can you state the main result for the width of resonance?
Yeah. The width of resonance?
Yeah, just what is the main result? You don't have to go to the
domain. I need space. The scattering length, let's say, A behaves like this psi star G squared. If I choose real, you know, divided by delta E, and delta E by so it is E minus 2 Bohr magneton times B. Let's say minus E res, and E res equals 2 of magneton times B, say, I don't know, minus E naught, something like this. Now, what I call the width of the resonance is if I write it like, let's say, gamma E minus E res. One over, let's see, minus E res divided by gamma plus E divided by gamma. So this one I would call 1 over A plus R star K squared. This is a constant, and this is basically depends on the position of the resonant level. And this is 1 over, let's say, A. This is the real, independent of energy scattering length, right? And this is the first term, which goes quadratically with K, and R star, okay, I call it like this. If R star is larger than the physical range of the potential, then the resonant is narrow. If R star is smaller, then the resonance is wide. But in condensed matter, for example, if you consider the Fermi gas, then the criterion is like this. If R star is larger than the mean antiparticle separation, then the resonance is narrow. If R star is smaller, then it's wide, right? So, and R star is it's basically what is it? 1 over gamma. It's 1 over gamma. Yeah, with also the mass and H bar.
So what are typical numbers for R star?
For potassium, the resonance is narrow. My criterion is much more strict. So the resonances that are narrow from my point of view are extremely narrow from the condensed matter point of view, because R star is of the order of the range. And for potassium, it is like this. For lithium, it's also like this. But for example, there is a narrow resonance in lithium at 500 something Gauss. The width of the resonance is something like 0.1 Gauss. And this R star is 3 micrometers, something like this. So the R star is positive. It's always if you solve the potential scattering problem, then the range of the potential is negative. But R star is for a narrow resonance, R star is positive. It's always positive because gamma is positive. Gamma is the lifetime of a quasi-stationary state. It's always of the same sign. So which basically means that
matter of definition, but the effective range is negative for these, because it's one.
I'm sorry. But what I'm saying is that the scattering length as a function of E is always like this, and never like this. Yeah. But as a function of magnetic field, it depends, of course, on the difference of the magnetic moment. So it can be, as a function of magnetic field, it can be both. And if you assume that it's like this, you find very strange things happening. Like you have, bifurcation point, like you didn't have any states, and then you have two. And this is related to the fact that you know the quasi-stationary state is not decaying but gaining some,
So I wanted to add that in Landau-Lipschitz quantum mechanics, they prove a theorem that for a potential motion in a fully attractive potential, R star as defined here is always negative and is equal to the range of the potential. But the theorem does not apply to Fishbach resonance if you have several coupled channels, but the potential is not necessarily just attractive.
Is there some wisdom on what controls R star, the size of R star?
Yes. Well, I mean,
it's how we couple these channels, right?
Yeah. So the smaller the gamma, the larger the R star. Right. And for example, you cannot change R star for a magnetic Fishbach resonance, but for this guy, for example, you can, because the detuning gives you the scattering length, and the amplitude will give you gamma. Basically, you can change. But I understand that my understanding is R star is always large. They cannot make it small for these guys.
Another question: in the potential UT, are there typically any bound states or there are no bound states?
Actually, nice question. In UT, yes, plenty of them. And what I wanted to say, and I forgot, is that experimental problem is how far we should scan in the magnetic field in order to find at least one Fishbach resonance, right? And the answer to this question actually lies in C6 coefficient, surprisingly, because C6 coefficient gives you the distance between the levels in the closed channel potential. Well, basically, the distance between the levels in the closed channel potential, which one is this? Ah, I see what you asked, right, right. Okay. Okay, so let's say this one. This one. This is of the order of h bar squared divided by m re squared. Re is related to the range of the physical range of the potential, right? So by shifting these two guys with respect to each other, okay, the equation for the window, let's say, is 2 Bohr magneton times the width of the window where you should find the, is of the order of h bar squared divided by m re squared. Of course, the numbers can be easily, you know. And this one does not, you don't have to know the scattering length. You have to know only C6 coefficient because it gives you uniquely the distance between the levels, right? And typically it's like 1,000 Gauss, unfortunately, very unfortunately. People are looking now for lithium potassium Feshbach resonances and you know, it progresses very fast, so I cannot say today whether they didn't observe or they observed. Yesterday, I don't know, but a couple of months ago they didn't, you know, they didn't have a result yet.
So typically in experiments, the states that are actually relevant that they're probing are really highly excited vibrational states, right?
Yeah, the last.
Yeah, they look at the...
Yeah, the last one. Basically the last one, yes.
Is it three-body collision that controls those lifetimes?
Yeah, there are two-body collisions that, for example, well, when spin-flip leads you to, let's say, well, if you, okay, you can, well, if you come from here, then you can go, you know, you can go out from this channel with, you know, releasing the energy. Yeah, the three-body collisions that otherwise three. If you choose this lowest hyperfine state, then these are three-body collisions.
Okay, thanks.